For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Tonight we're going to review Genesis chapter 1:1. In the beginning, what? Well, depending on your worldview, you're going to have a different answer to this question. For some people, it's in the beginning, molecules in motion. For other people, it's mindless matter and energy. That at the root, at the foundation of the universe, it's just matter and energy, molecules in motion. The Christian worldview actually has a different perspective. It begins in this way. In the beginning, God, mind, the concept that there is a mind behind the universe. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. This would be a foundational passage to a Christian worldview, a way of viewing the world. Think about it. Without God, you can't have the Bible, which is the Word of God, right? You can't have miracles, which are acts of God. You can't have Jesus, who is the Son of God. We need God. We need to start with God. So I wonder if it wasn't in God's providence that He opened up the Bible with this verse. What does this imply? This verse really has a multitude of implications, but let's just look at three. This teaches that God is infinite, He's personal, He's volitional, He can act, He can create things. It seems to imply that God is self-existent, that He existed before creation. He existed sans creation, apart from creation. In the beginning, God was already there. He's already existent. Think of Jude, verse 25, where Jude says that God existed before all time. He existed in a timeless state apart from creation. Second, it tells us that God is distinct from creation. This wouldn't be similar to a pantheistic notion that God and creation are one, or a panentheism where the creation is God's body, so to speak. This verse is teaching that God is separate, He's distinct from creation. Also, that He creates creation. That might be a little bit redundant, but we might as well point that out. He creates it ex nihilo. This comes from the Latin ex is the preposition, which means out of or from, and nihil. Think of that one movie where they say, we are nihilists. We believe in nothing. Correct answer, nothing. Ex nihilo, from nothing, from nothing. Bruce Waltke is an Old Testament Hebrew scholar. He says that this merism, this combination of words, the heavens and the earth, the combination of these words represents the entirety of the cosmos, the organized universe. When you put heavens separate or earth separate, it's one thing. But when you bring them together, it's like saying, baby, I love you from your head to your toes. Anyways, okay, let's just keep going. Three lines of evidence. Why should we believe that this is true? Okay. We can see this is a distinct worldview. We can see that it's a favorable worldview. How do we know it's the real worldview? Well, I'd like to give three lines of evidence, which I think are pretty persuasive for believing in this concept of creation. First, the origin of the material universe. Second, the organization of the laws, constants, and initial conditions of the universe. And then third, the origin of life. If you're here tonight and you're trying to check out what you believe about spiritual things and you're trying to investigate for yourself and you're exploring what you believe, I'd like to make an agreement. What I'd like to do is do my very best to lay out this evidence. And I'd like to ask from you just to do your very best to keep an open mind. Okay? That's all I'm asking for here. Are you the kind of person who's open-minded, who wants to explore other perspectives? Well, if you are, just keep an open mind, and then it's up to you. You got to take this on what you think for yourself. So let's get started with that first line of evidence, the origin of the material universe. You ever just ask yourself the question, why is the universe here? How did it get here? Why is there a universe rather than no universe? Or to quote the famous philosopher Leibniz, why is there something rather than nothing? Well, the prevalent view throughout history is that the universe just existed. It was just a brute fact that the universe is here. You think of, the contrary or the surrounding worldviews around the Hebrews. You know, the Sumerians, Assyrians, Egyptians, Babylonians believed that the gods, plural, were derivative of matter and energy. But matter and energy already existed. So when the gods came into being, they started to organize matter and energy together. But it was assumed that the universe, matter and energy, has always existed. As we travel down through the centuries, we see as we reach the Enlightenment and the Renaissance and the Victorian era, most people in the Western world believed that the universe has just always existed. There was just one funny group of people who protested. People who believed in the Bible. People who were Jews or Christians. People who believed in the first verse of the Bible. Or think of John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then verse 3, all things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being. These Jews and Christians were kind of the oddballs. They were the strange ones. This is so much the case that in 1948, on the BBC radio, National International Public Radio, Frederick Copleston, the philosopher, could argue with the atheistic philosopher Bertrand Russell and ask the question, Dr. Russell, why is the universe here? And Bertrand Russell, in his very sexy British accent, could say, the universe is just there, and that's all. That's really sexy. I'm going to have nightmares about it. And that was the end of the discussion for Russell. Today, there's actually two independent lines of evidence that show us that the universe did have a space-time beginning, as the Bible has said all the way. In the 20th century, modern science has caught up with the view that the universe had an origin in space and time. The first line of evidence is the second law of thermodynamics, and the second is what is referred to as Big Bang cosmology. So let's start with that first one. This is a mouthful. The second law of thermodynamics, what are you talking about? Well, put simply, the second law of thermodynamics teaches that the amount of usable energy will decrease in a closed system. Well, that doesn't make it any easier. Could you explain that further? Yeah. What I don't mean to say is that energy disappears. That would be to contradict the first law, the conservation of mass energy. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed. Yes? The second law doesn't say that energy disappears. It just says that it can't be used as effectively as we might want it to. Let's think about this. Have you ever heard of Newton's cradle balance balls? Newton's cradle balance balls are these things. These are like the kind of ornaments you find on a rich executive's table. Well, what happens? Do the Newton's cradle balance balls go on forever? No, why not? Well, the second law of thermodynamics is in view here, isn't it? That the amount of usable energy, you can input energy into a closed system, but eventually entropy increases and you reach a state of stasis, static. The energy isn't able to be used anymore. Let's think of a different example. Imagine you're in some kind of a Twilight Zone, Dark Mirror, M. Night Shyamalan movie, right? And you're the last person on Earth. Finally, you come into a coffee shop and you find a cup of coffee where there's steam coming from the top of the coffee. And there's a lit cigarette on the coffee table. You're like, it's a twist, yes. It's a twist. What would you assume? Would you assume that the heat, the usable energy in that coffee cup, had just been there for 20 years? Or would the goosebumps go off on the back of your neck and start to think somebody imported energy into that coffee pot to make the coffee hot, and that's why it's steaming? Now, what does this all have to do with cosmology, you ask? Here's my point. The universe itself is a closed system. It has a boundary, a space-time boundary. So we have pockets of heat and light. We call these stars. But here's the difficulty. If the universe is eternal, if the universe has always been here, why haven't all of the stars used up their energy already? Let me push that a step further. Why haven't they used up their energy an eternity ago? This implies that the universe was infused with energy a finite time ago. Paul Davies, the agnostic physicist, writes this. He says that the universe is like a clock slowly winding down. But how did it get wound up in the first place? That's the second law of thermodynamics at work. The second line of evidence, which is more persuasive to me, it's what's referred to as Big Bang cosmology. You guys ready for a movie? All right, this is from Stephen Hawking's Into the Universe. Check this out.
In fact, the whole universe is expanding in all directions, getting bigger and bigger, like a balloon inflating. I admit this sounds strange, but to cosmologists, it's like winning the lottery. Because to work out where the universe came from, all we need to do is to stop time and make it run in reverse. Rewind far enough, and everything gets closer together. A lot closer together. All the galaxies, in fact, every single thing, converges to a single point, the start of everything, 13.7 billion years ago. So it's quite simple, really. Follow the clues, and we can deduce that a very long time ago, the universe simply burst into existence. An event called the Big Bang.
Okay, he said that the universe burst into existence. If we follow Einstein's theory of relativity, general relativity, all the way back to the beginning, this would mean that this singularity, this isn't a cause of the universe. It's a description of the origin of the universe. That we start with infinite density, no volume, infinite mass, the origin of space and time as we know it, which would mean this would also include the origin of all matter and energy, because matter and energy exist within space and time. So what we're talking about here isn't like a religious theory. This isn't like creation science or something like that, where we have humans riding dinosaurs and, you know, museums about these kind of things. What we're talking about here is actually a scientific theory, which is held by the overwhelming consensus of modern cosmologists and physicists today. The standard model points back to a beginning of the universe. Let me back that up. Here's Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose. These are colleagues of one another. They're both agnostic physicists at Cambridge or Oxford University. They write this in their lecture series, The Nature of Space and Time. They write this: almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Time began at this moment. John Barrow, an agnostic physicist, this is from the University of Cambridge, he says, at this singularity, space and time came into existence. Literally, nothing existed before the singularity. So, if the universe originated at such a singularity, we would truly have a creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. Alexander Vilenkin, Arvin Bord, and Alan Guth in 2003 wrote a prominent paper on this topic where they showed that no matter what model you take, whether you take the standard Friedmann-Lemaître model, the Big Bang theory, or if you take some of the offshoots, the inflationary model, there's a bunch of different ones, even a multiverse, if you believe in that. Vilenkin and his colleagues showed that no matter what view you hold, it all points back to a beginning of the universe. And this is what he says in his 2006 book. Vilenkin writes this. He says, it is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. So, what we're talking about here up until this point is relatively uncontroversial. We're just talking about the scientific facts and the consensus that scientists hold on this topic. What's more controversial is how we interpret these facts. Like if we were two detectives coming to a scene, how would we interpret the data? The data is there. The forensic science is there. The question is, how do we know who is culpable, who is responsible? In this setting, which worldview makes the most sense of the data? Well, here's an atheistic philosopher from Western Michigan University, Quentin Smith. This is what he has to say. He says, the most reasonable belief is that we came from nothing, we came by nothing, and we came for nothing. Okay, I know a lot of us here didn't study philosophy or you're not into it, but you don't need to be a philosopher to understand what he's saying. The most reasonable belief is that the universe popped into existence from what? From nothing. That's reasonable. You think that's the most reasonable thing? Here's another atheist, J.L. Mackey. He says this: there is no good reason why an origination of things not determined by anything, no cause, should be unacceptable, whereas the existence of a God is acceptable. Well, I'd just like to ask you the question. You can make up your own mind here. Is it more reasonable to believe for you that something created everything or that nothing created everything? To me, that's a no-brainer. I mean, to say that something could pop into existence from nothing would be really to stretch my credulity. But to say that everything popped into existence from nothing just seems to me to be patently absurd. So I'll leave it to you to decide. Well, that's the first line of evidence. What about the second line? The organization of the universe. Well, in the last 40 to 50 years, physicists have discovered that the laws, constants, and initial conditions of the universe have been exquisitely finely tuned to allow for life. Here's one example. This would be the gravitational constant. As you look at this constant, you have M1 and M2. M1 would be the mass of the first object, let's say a planet, and M2 is the mass of a second object, let's say a billiard ball, okay? So M1 multiplied by M2 multiplied by the gravitational constant divided by the distance squared between the two objects. Well, all of those numbers change. The mass of one object and a second object and then the distance between. All of those always change in this formula except for one, the gravitational constant. It has a specific setting. It's always the same. The question which has puzzled physicists is why? Why is the gravitational constant what it is? Why is that the figure that we plug in and it's always the same? Why isn't it bigger? Why isn't it smaller? Well, Richard Dawkins, now this is from his book, The God Delusion, so this isn't like a guy who would support me in any way. Okay, he says this. He says that physicists have calculated that if the laws and constants of physics had been even slightly different, the universe would have developed in such a way that life would have been impossible. Different physicists put it in different ways, but the conclusion is almost always the same. Yeah, if these constants and quantities and initial conditions were just slightly different, life would not exist. Here's John Barrow from Cambridge. He says this: at first, one might imagine that a change in the value of a constant would simply shift the size of everything a little, but that there would still exist stars and atoms. However, this turns out to be too naive a view. Indeed, there is every reason to suspect that we would not be here to discuss the matter. Stephen Hawking, agnostic physicist, this is in his book, The Grand Design, 2010, he co-authored it with Leonard Mlodinow, he writes this, or they write this: if the other nuclear force, the weak force, were much weaker in the early universe, all of the hydrogen in the cosmos would have turned to helium. That's not good, okay? That would not be good for life. And hence, there would be no normal stars. Like, if this constant was a little different, on the order of 1 in 10 to the 100th power, okay? 1 out of 10 with 100 zeros after it, the weak nuclear force. Yeah, if it was just much weaker, I mean slightly weaker. He says, on the other hand, if it were much stronger, exploding supernovas would not eject their outer envelopes and hence would fail to seed interstellar space with the heavy elements planets require to foster life. The laws of nature form a system that is extremely finely tuned, and very little in physical law can be altered without destroying the possibility of the development of life as we know it. That is not easily explained and raises the natural question of why it is that way. Good question. So again, we're agreeing on the data. We see these are extraordinarily finely tuned. The question is, how is it that we explain it? Martin Rees, who looks like he should be in one of the Star Wars films. I don't know why. I just, like, I'm sure he's like a nice guy. He just kind of like looks like an emperor kind of a bit. Anyways, he's a cosmologist. He's talking about the N constant here, which is the gravity electrical force. He says this number measures the strengths of the electrical forces that hold atoms together divided by the force of gravity between them. We have no theory that tells us the value of N. All that we know is that nothing as complex as humankind could have emerged if N were much less than 10 to the 37th power. That's a 10 with 37 zeros after it. The first thing we could take away is that chance can't explain these constants. For some reason, this reminded me of a really instrumental movie in my life that speaks about this. So let's check this out.
I'd say more like one out of a million.
So you're telling me there's a chance? Yeah!
We laugh at that joke from Jim Carrey because he's like one out of a million. And he's like, oh, there's still a chance. Well, what we're talking about here is, taken to the extreme. Roger Penrose of Oxford University, he says that the uniqueness of the Big Bang singularity is one out of 10 billion raised to the 123rd power. Just to give you some idea on how big of a number that is, the universe has existed for 13.72 billion years. If we were to put that in the form of seconds, that would be 10 to the 18th seconds. That's a 10 with 18 zeros after it. This is 10 billion to the 123rd power. A number so extraordinary, it makes that other one just seem completely wimpy by comparison. Paul Davies, agnostic physicist, he says, had the explosion of the Big Bang differed in strength at the outset by only one part in 10 to the 60th power, the universe we now perceive would not exist. That gives some meaning to these numbers. Suppose you wanted to fire a bullet at a one-inch target on the other side of the observable universe, 20 billion light years away. Your aim would have to be accurate to that same part in 10 to the 60th power. That's just one of the constants we're talking about here. Let me give you another example. The amount of protons, neutrons, and electrons in our universe, okay, so subatomic particles, is estimated to be 10 to the 80th power. So to pluck out a proton at random and not be the right one, that's 1 out of 10 to the 80th power. This is 1 out of 10 to the 60th power. The other figure was 10 billion raised to the 123rd power. Here's Hugh Ross. Now, this is the only Christian I'm going to quote tonight, but I'm not quoting him for his science. He is credentialed as a scientist and everything, but this is just a really good illustration, so check this out. He says, one part in 10 to the 37 is such an incredibly sensitive balance that it's hard to visualize. The following analogy might help. Cover the entire North American continent in dimes all the way up to the moon, a height of 239,000 miles. So that would look like this right here, okay? You're Neil Armstrong on the moon. You're looking down at Earth, just dimes all the way down. Ross says this, next, pile dimes from here to the moon on a billion other continents the same size as North America. So the entire continental U.S. and North America covered with dimes, 239,000 miles, and then we're going to do that on a billion other continents. He says, paint one dime red and mix it in with the billions of other dimes. Blindfold a friend and ask him to pick out the one dime. The odds that it'll pick the red dime are 1 in 10 to the 37th power. Okay, so these figures, I know they're mind-blowing. The chance, you can't say chance, explains this. And there's several dozen of these. Okay, so just to put this in perspective, we got one constant here. The speed of the expansion of the Big Bang. Let's be really conservative. Davy says it's 10 to the 60th. Let's be really conservative, 10 to the 55th power. Well, that's one. Then we have the strength of gravity. Remember that formula I showed you? That is finely tuned, one part in 10 to the 40th power, 40 zeros. But notice, it isn't enough just to get one of these lined up. You got to get both of them lined up in the same area for the universe to be permitting rather than prohibiting. You got the mass of the universe, one part in 10 to the 59th power. You've got the ratio of electrons to protons. Those would be the quantities rather than the constants, 10 to the 37th. The cosmological constant, check this out, 1 in 10 to the 120th power. Okay, and we see, as we look at all these, Paul Davies points out that there's 30 of these constants, and we're still discovering more. So, I guess my point here is that as believers in Christ, what we're not saying is that we're using our creation science, right? Everybody agrees on these figures. The question is, how do we interpret them? What do we do with them? How did it get that way? I could ask you the same question. What do you think is the best explanation for that extraordinarily exquisite fine-tuning? Some people say chance. Oh, man. Come on. How could you possibly say chance? That just doesn't even seem likely. I was talking with one guy. He said, well, aliens. Aliens did it. He's watching too much History Channel or something. I don't know, but I was like, dude, aliens, if they existed, would be within the universe. We're talking about the formation of the universe, the initial conditions. That's impossible. E.T. could not do this, okay? Well, another suggestion is the multiverse. The multiverse. I remember talking to one guy about this. He said, yeah, I just think there's an infinite number of universes. And if you have an infinite number of universes, then eventually one of them is going to hit the jackpot, and that just so happens to be us. I said, that's interesting. So what's the evidence for the multiverse? None. George Ellis, Scientific American, 2010, the most eminent cosmologist in the world today. He says that the multiverse can't be discovered even in principle. We could never discover it. Because if there even is a multiverse, these universes, bubble universes, would be spreading away. We could never possibly discover it. Plus, let's say you bought into that. Let's say you believe that there's an infinite number of universes. That wouldn't just explain this improbability. That would explain every improbability for the rest of your life. So you're playing poker for $1,000 a hand, and your buddy gets dealt the four aces 10 times in a row. And just when you go to clock him in the nose and beat him up, he says, whoa, dude, there's an infinite number of universes, and given enough universes, I know it's improbable, but we happen to be in the one where the four aces were dealt 10 times in a row. Occam's razor would say that we shouldn't multiply entities beyond necessity. Is it more believable to believe in an infinite number of unobservable universes, or is it more believable to believe in just one singular creator? Well, finally, the origin of life. Matthias Schleiden and Theodor Schwann, it's from 1830s. They were the first to look through a microscope at the cell. Here's a Schwann's drawing of the cell. He just thought it was basically like a sack of jelly, protoplasm. Today, almost two centuries later, we know that the cell, microscopic life organisms, are not just a sack of jelly. They're like little cities. We're going to check this out together, okay? At the very least, cells have amino acids, which are the basic building blocks of life. There's 20 in all amino acids. Then there's DNA, which is the information which orders the amino acids. As you form amino acids and arrange them according to the specifications of the DNA, what you find is that the amino acids need to be arranged and they need to be folded in a precise way in order to make a protein. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. DNA gives the instruction for amino acids. Those letters form a language in DNA, and they're specified. It's not just complex. They give instructions. Richard Dawkins, again, he's an atheistic scientist. He says that the genetic code is truly digital in exactly the same sense as computer codes. A study was done back in 2012 by a bunch of grad students and PhDs. They found that just 1 gram of DNA on your finger could store 700 terabytes of data. This is one of the most elegant, well, it is the most elegant storage facility we've ever discovered. And it's coursing through our veins, pumping out information, pumping out cells, repairing at an incredible speed. In fact, let's look at this little video I got here. RNA to protein. This is in real time here.
When the RNA copy is complete, it snakes out into the outer part of the cell. Then, in a dazzling display of choreography, all the components of a molecular machine lock together around the RNA to form a miniature factory called a ribosome. It translates the genetic information in the RNA into a string of amino acids that will become a protein. Special transfer molecules, the green triangles, bring each amino acid to the ribosome. The amino acids are the small red tips attached to the transfer molecules. There are different transfer molecules for each of the 20 amino acids. Each transfer molecule carries a 3-letter code that is matched with the RNA in the machine. Now we come to the heart of the process. Inside the ribosome, the RNA is pulled through like a tape. The code for each amino acid is read off, 3 letters at a time, and matched to 3 corresponding letters on the transfer molecules. When the right transfer molecule plugs in, the amino acid it carries is added to the growing protein chain. Again, you are watching this in real time. And after a few seconds, the assembled protein starts to emerge from the ribosome. Ribosomes can make any kind of protein. It just depends what genetic message you feed in on the RNA. In this case, the end product is hemoglobin. The cells in our bone marrow churn out 100 trillion molecules of it per second.
100 trillion molecules of it per second. Here's Dawkins here. He says there is enough storage capacity in the DNA of a single lily seed or a single salamander sperm. I don't know why he chose that out of the hat, but to store the Encyclopedia Britannica 60 times over. He says this, amoebas have as much information in their DNA as 1,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas. You know what an amoeba is? One of the simplest forms of life. It's so rich with information. In Dawkins' words, Paul Davies refers to this as a supercomputer, the cell. Okay, so what are our options here? I've talked to some people who have said, well, I believe in evolution, and evolution can account, the process can account for the origin of life. Well, we already talked about evolution last week, and I'm open to evolution on some level, but not on this level. This is off limits. Why? Are you just being prejudicial that you don't think evolution can count? No, it's that it can't start life. Natural selection only takes place after life exists. There's no way you can have natural selection without life. Here's Richard Dawkins again, our boy. He says the origin of life, by contrast, lies outside the reach of evolution because natural selection cannot proceed without it. Theodosius Dobzhansky, who's a leading 20th century evolutionary biologist, he says pre-biological, so before biology, before life, pre-biological natural selection is a contradiction in terms. You can't have it. It doesn't exist. So the question is, how do you get a self-replicating cell? How do you get the cell wall? How do you get the DNA, the information, the ribosomes, the machinery? Where does that all come from? Well, there's a number of difficulties which to me seem insuperable if you're just looking on a naturalistic perspective. The first is what is referred to as the chicken and the egg problem. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Think of M.C. Escher, where one hand is drawing the other, right? Well, which one of them started drawing the other? Well, that's the point. You're supposed to look at the drawing. Anyways, same thing here. Proteins and DNA. Let's think about this for a second. Now, proteins. You'd have structural proteins. These would be like the cell wall. Boy, you'd need that. You need a cell wall in the early Earth. You know, 3.8 billion years ago, you've got this goo. You need a cell wall to keep your information from just floating into the ocean. It's got to be separate. You need functional proteins, the proteins which transport materials within the cell to be able to replicate, to be able to mitosis, meiosis. And then regulatory proteins as well, enzymes. These control the chemical reactions in the cell. So a multifaceted number of proteins in the cell for replication. Here's the problem. DNA has the instructions and can arrange these amino acids for protein assembly. But the difficulty is you need the proteins to protect, unzip, and release the DNA to become messenger RNA. So which came first, the DNA instructions to create the proteins or the proteins to unzip and protect the DNA? It's an insuperable problem. It's been bugging biologists for years. Number two, what's called the chirality of amino acids. Amino acids are handed. That's what chirality means. They're lefties and righties. Well, what we need with these amino acids is a homochirality, one-handedness. So proteins cannot assemble unless all of them are right-handed or all of them are left-handed amino acids. So let's think about this. Even a string of like a short string, 100 amino acids put together. It's all 50% probability for the first one, 50% for the second, 50% for the third. That'd be like flipping a quarter 100 times in a row and getting heads each time. That doesn't even begin to say, are they in the right order? That's just all saying, are they the right chirality? Are they homochirality? That leads to incredible improbabilities. And then finally, once we got the right chirality, the right type of amino acids, they have to be sequenced in the right order. So it'd be like if I got this message from my buddy that said, come on, let's go eat, man. And then just one of those things was off in that message, and it said, come on, let's go eat man. That'd be the difference between having dinner with Anthony Hopkins or being dinner for Anthony Hopkins, right? Specified complexity. That's the same thing here. When we think of the disease, sickle cell anemia, do you know what causes that? One amino acid in one protein is misplaced. Just one. And that is a fatal condition. So if you want to start talking about 2, 3, 7 being off, okay, that would completely stop the process of specified complexity for life. There's 20 different forms of amino acids that we're talking about here, and arranging them, even in a short, you know, chain of, let's say, 150, produces statistics and statistical figures like 10 to the 195th power. That's to get a simple chain of amino acids. Nothing like what we're talking about here. Something rudimentary to get the process going. Even conservative figures, where they try and shorten down these chains of amino acids. Let's just do 100. Anywhere from 10 to the 63rd or 10 to the 77th power. That's like almost as many as the number of protons, neutrons, and electrons in the observable universe. To get a simple form of life. And so this has had people bamboozled for years. I mean, how do we get this happening? Klaus Dose, biochemist, this is 1988. He says, more than 30 years of experimentation on the origin of life have led to a better perception of the immensity of the problem of the origin of life rather than to its solution. At present, all discussions on principal theories and experiments in the field either end in stalemate or in a confession of ignorance. Well, that was 1988. Come on, that was like 30 years ago. All right, James Shapiro, 1996, leading molecular biologist, still around today, still doing work. He says there are no detailed Darwinian accounts for the evolution of any fundamental biochemical or cellular system, only a variety of wishful speculations. Flash forward to 1999, Paul Davies, The Fifth Miracle. He says, when I set out to write this book, I was convinced that science was close to wrapping up the mystery of life's origins. Having spent a year or two researching the field, I am now of the opinion that there remains a huge gulf in our understanding. This gulf in understanding is not merely ignorance about certain technical details. It is a huge conceptual lacuna. A conceptual lacuna, a conceptual gulf. It's almost like we're looking at this thing and it's like we're missing something. Like there's a solution here that could explain this, but we won't allow it in the picture. Almost like it was designed. Yeah, I mean, you look at that footage. Looking at something like that, that looks like something you'd see in an alien spacecraft in a science fiction film. It looks designed. It's more elegant than anything we've ever created as an engineer. Well, even more recently, Davy says the problem of the origin of life is nowhere near being solved. We're not any closer today than we've ever been. Franklin Harold, microbiologist, he says, of all the unsolved mysteries remaining in science, the most consequential may be the origin of life. The origin of life is also a stubborn problem with no solution in sight. I think I might know why that is. It could be because we're looking for a naturalistic explanation and there isn't one. Well, like some people come over to my house after this meeting and we got these magnets up on the fridge and sometimes they write like inappropriate things in the magnets. You know, imagine if I was just going up and looking at these messages in the magnets and I kept trying to come up with naturalistic theories as to how that happened. Well, maybe the door was left open. There was enough wind that could create enough movement. No. Well, maybe my dog bumped it into the refrigerator. No. Maybe there was an earthquake and it shook up the magnets. No, 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 no. It was a person in my home church who did that. So let's review. I said that I give you three lines of evidence. And to me, I guess I'll give you my take on this. I'm pretty persuaded. It isn't that I don't have doubts. I have doubts too, just like anybody else. What I am saying is that this evidence to me is so overwhelming that I'd be willing to bet my adult life on it. I'd be willing to dedicate the rest of my adult life to serving God and to knowing God and trusting that He's there. I'm not the only one though. Actually, there was this atheistic philosopher. His name is Antony Flew. He was the leading atheist of the 20th century. Here's a little video of him where he's in a debate with some Christians kind of talking about his views. And it turns out he actually came to believe in God. So check this out.
We all are all of us, indeed, atheists, positive atheists, in respect of the God or gods of most religions. I'm suggesting that we should all start from, take as given our everyday, undisputed, common sense knowledge of the world and our reservoir of scientific knowledge.
You know, 50 years ago, when he got his start as a professional philosopher, they hadn't discovered this stuff. Since then, they did. And Flew was intellectually honest enough to say that if there were scientific discoveries, he would come to believe in God. So after 50 years of being a professional atheistic philosopher, Anthony Flew wrote the book, There Is a God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Came to Change His Mind. And so let's look at our conclusions for tonight. Okay, what if there was just a 1% chance that what I'm saying is true? How much faith do you need to see if God is really there? For me, I had to call out to God. I wasn't sure. So I prayed this prayer, and it was probably the worst prayer in history. God, I don't know if you're there, but maybe you are, but I don't think you are. I think you could be, but I don't think so, but it's possible. And I felt kind of stupid, honestly. I was talking to the ceiling in my bedroom, and I wasn't really sure if anyone was listening. But I feel like that's intellectually honest, to be able just to turn to God and say, if you're there, I want to meet you personally. But I have a follow-up question for you. How much faith do you need to receive a gift from God? That's what we're talking about here. I hope you don't think I'm trying to argue you into some kind of awful conclusion, like God exists and he hates you. The truth is God exists and he loves you more than you could ever imagine. The God who created 100 billion galaxies wants to know you so badly that he would pay the unthinkable price of the cross of Christ to come and meet you. And the Bible teaches you don't have to be 100% certain to receive Christ. I'm not 100%. Nobody's 100% certain. Do you have enough trust? Do you have enough faith to turn to God and just say, if that's true, if what you did there at the cross is real, if you're real, I want that for myself. The Bible says at that moment, when you just have the humility to ask for that gift in your life, that you come into a relationship with this God that we've been talking about tonight. You should think about that. Why don't we pray here together and we'll close up. Yep, we know that these lines of evidence aren't overwhelming, and yet they are pretty persuasive, Lord, and I find them that they really build my faith in you. But we do know that there is an element of the will where we have to actually turn and trust you. We can't just expect that this relationship with you is going to happen to us. It's something that we have to choose. So I pray for those of us here tonight who are maybe wrestling in their faith and they haven't taken their dedication to you to the next level. I pray that they would be encouraged to take a step forward and to trust you even deeper in their commitment to Christ. And Lord, I pray for those folks here with us tonight who can't remember a time that they ever started a relationship with you. We pray that they would put an end to that tonight and be able to open their hearts and to pray that if you're there and you really did go to the extreme to love them, that they could accept that for themselves and come to know you and your love personally. In Jesus' name, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.